From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. During the Soviet coup, film director Andrei Konchalovsky broke the curfew to continue post-production work on his latest film, the first Hollywood film to be shot on location in the Kremlin and KGB headquarters. Konchalovsky is a Soviet emigre from one of Russia's most celebrated artist families. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Konchalovsky about his life and his new film, which stars Tom Hulce as Stalin's film projectionist. Also today, what we don't want for the holidays, the flu. We talk with Dr. Walter Gunn of the Centers for Disease Control. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews new albums by James Taylor and Warren Zevon. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The United Nations General Assembly has voted to rescind its so-called Zionism is Racism resolution. The vote was 111 to 25 with 13 abstentions. NPR's Jim Zeroli reports.
The measure has long been a source of great anger for Israel. The decision to overturn it today came after an intense lobbying campaign by the Bush administration at the UN. Assistant U.S. Secretary of State Lawrence Eagleburger noted today that many of the Third World and former Soviet bloc countries that voted for the measure 16 years ago were among those voting to overturn it today.
We believe that with the world's and this body's passage into a new era, it is more than time to consign one of the last relics of the Cold War to the dustbin of history.
But several Arab countries, including Algeria, Yemen, and Sudan, warned that the move today would anger many fundamentalist Arabs and derail the Mideast peace process now underway in Washington. At the UN, this is Jim Zeroli reporting.
Russian President Boris Yeltsin said today that he expects at least 10 of the 12 former Soviet republics to have joined the new Commonwealth of Independent States when it begins operation by the end of this month. Yeltsin also denied reports that he and the Soviet defense minister have agreed to name Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev as commander-in-chief of the Commonwealth. The Russian president didn't rule out some job in the new regime for Gorbachev. Yeltsin spoke to reporters after a four-hour meeting today with Secretary of State James Baker, in which he assured Baker that the Commonwealth will retain strict control over the Soviet nuclear arsenal. The defense in the Manuel Noriega drug trial has requested more time to prepare its case. The former Panamanian dictator was to begin his defense tomorrow, but a delay was requested because of a discovery that has the potential to clear him. From Miami, Melissa Mancini has more.
This past weekend, information surfaced about a covert U.S. drug enforcement operation General Noriega participated in. According to sources close to the case, Operation Negocio came to light last week during a meeting between government prosecutors and DEA operatives. Apparently, Noriega assisted agents in identifying pilots and planes flying money into Panama in the 1980s. The agents, who are under subpoena by the defense, are willing to testify Noriega helped halt major drug operations. Sources close to the case say it could prove General Noriega's innocence. Information on the DEA operation wasn't turned over to the defense until last Friday, and they say there hasn't been enough time to analyze the file. For National Public Radio, I'm Melissa Mancini in Miami.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street, boosted by speculation that the Federal Reserve will decide to lower interest rates still further at its meeting tomorrow. The Dow Industrials gained nearly 5 points to finish the day at 2,919. This is NPR. Former California Governor Jerry Brown continued his attack against what he calls a money-driven political system today. After defying the rules of a televised debate last night by broadcasting his own 800 number for campaign donations, Brown held a news conference this morning to say that he's acting in the best interest of Americans. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
If Jerry Brown scored any points in last night's televised candidates' forum, it was in the area of consistency. He consistently stuck to one theme, that the American people have lost control of their political system to career politicians who are bought off by special interests. Brown is considered a long shot in the race. He put a $100 limit on contributions and has had trouble raising money. Twice on the show, he announced an 800 number for donations. Today, he held a press conference on Capitol Hill to say that he had never promised NBC he wouldn't solicit money. Some call Brown's criticism of the system hypocritical, since he spent most of his life in politics, but he says he's changed.
I'm part of it. I've lived in it. I breathe it. I think it. But I am determined to move out of it.
Brown says he received 4,000 to 5,000 calls last night after announcing his number and raised over $150,000 in pledges. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Washington.
Canada announced today that it's reached a land settlement with its Arctic native people, creating an Inuit homeland that will cover 770,000 square miles. The new territory, to be called Nunavut, will be carved out of the existing Northwest Territories and will stretch from the northern tree line almost to the North Pole. The area is home to almost 18,000 Inuit, the native name that's preferred by the people who were formerly known as Eskimos. Canada's Indian Affairs Minister said that the land claim settlement gives the Inuit direct control over 136,000 square miles and a cash payment of more than $1 billion over 14 years. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest's father wrote the lyrics for the national anthem of the late Soviet Union. Andrei Konchalovsky is an emigre film director and a member of an eminent family of Russian artists. His grandfather and great-grandfather were famous painters. His brother, Nikita Mikhalkov, is an actor and director who's been called the Robert Redford of Russia. As for my guest, Andrei Konchalovsky, he was one of Russia's most highly regarded directors. His post-war epic, Siberiad, was the highest-grossing Russian film ever made. After Siberiad was completed in 1979, he left the country in search of artistic and personal freedom. His wife is French, so he was able to leave Russia to be with her. Konchalovsky has since made several films in the United States, including Shy People and Runaway Train. He returned to Russia to make his new film, The Inner Circle. It's based on the true story of Stalin's film projectionist. It stars Tom Hulce as the projectionist and Bob Hoskins as the head of the KGB. This was the first major motion picture filmed inside the Kremlin and the KGB headquarters. Before we spoke about his new film, Konchalovsky told me how he feels about the end of the Soviet Union.
I feel very good about the end of the Soviet Union because nothing can be worse than the system that doesn't work and the beliefs that are false. So I think it's for good, but it's good, and I think it's for the good of the people, but it's not very easy, and the times had very difficult times.
Your new movie, The Inner Circle, is about Stalinist projectionist. You actually knew Stalinist projectionist. How did you meet
him? I know him. He's alive.
He's still alive.
Oh, he's still alive. He lives in Moscow, and he's a Stalinist.
He's still a Stalinist.
Oh, he's a staunch Stalinist, and when you speak with him, it's very difficult to beat him because his stand is, Stalin was a great leader. Yes, he was severe. Yes, he put some people in prison. Yes, but he delivered goods. We had sausage, we had milk, we had bread. Every year there was some kind of, the prices went down, and now Gorbachev destroyed everything. We don't have anything, just words. And we don't have any sausage, we don't have food. And it's very difficult to speak with him about it because, you know, that's true. Freedom is a great thing, but you cannot eat freedom and you cannot wear freedom when it's cold.
How did you meet Stalin's projectionist?
I met him, you know, it was 25 years ago. I made a film that was about some Gulag's victims. And it was time of, you know, middle 60s when it was Khrushchev's thaw, and Solzhenitsyn printed his book, that published his book, first book that made him so famous. And I made a film about Stalin, victims of Gulag. But it was a time when it was started already, the thaw, they decided to stop it, to stop the Stalinization, and my film was banned. So I went, I had to present my film to the censorship, and the projectionist in the censorship committee was this man with white hair, very thin, very lean, very agile. I asked him, listen, can you do me a favor? I cannot attend this meeting. Can you just snitch for me? Can you listen what the people are going to talk and then tell me? Because I'd like to know why they're going what are the arguments to ban the film? And he did it for me. And I came later on, and he told me what he heard through the, you know, through the partition as a projectionist, what they're talking about in the screening room. And then he dropped a couple of words like, you know, they are not really bosses. Once I show the film to the real master, and I asked him who, and he said, you know, Stalin. And, you know, I just flip out, and I said, unbelievable. Tell me more. Did you show really? And he told me about his life when he showed films to Stalin, and how he was brought up. First, they took him from his bed at middle of the night, the KGB officers, and brought him to Kremlin, and he didn't know where even they are driving him, where he's going. He thought he's arrested, and they brought him to Kremlin, and put him in the projection room and say, are you ready to show the films? And he didn't know even who he's going to show the film. And then he found out that it was Stalin, whose projectionist got sick.
I think your movie, in a way, tries to answer the question, why would somebody remain loyal to Stalin? Why would somebody be loyal to Stalin in the first place? And what effect would that loyalty have on their lives as they got older?
Yeah, you know, that was my main goal, to share with the world. There are several goals why I wanted to make this film, because I knew this system pretty well. But I wanted to study this phenomena, because, you know, if Stalin was so bad, and it's very easy to show Stalin as a monster, and there were several films that showed, you know, Stalin or Mussolini or, you know, big dictators as bad people. That's easy. It's what is difficult is to understand why millions of people in different countries followed and cherished and, you know, worshiped these people, like, you know, like Stalin or like Mussolini or Perón in Argentina, or you can take even Khomeini. I mean, millions of Iranians hailed Khomeini as a character. We cannot say that they're all, you know, crazy people. It's a nation. The phenomenon of it's very, very interesting, sometimes frightening, but there is a kind of a seduction the idea that seduces and can seduce the whole nation. You're lucky in this country.
Does the story that you're telling hit close to home? And what I'm thinking of is that your father, I believe, got a writing award from Stalin, and I think it was Stalin who asked your father to write the national anthem.
My father participated, among other writers, in the competition for the best lyrics for the national anthem. And there were maybe 20 or 25 prominent Soviet writers that wrote different lyrics for that competition. And then it was a call from Stalin to my father, and I remember that time. And of course, you know, Stalin liked to call himself to shock people in the middle of the night. And my father was told that his texts, his lyrics, are better than other ones, and they won the competition. So he was brought to Kremlin, and in the middle of the night, it was a dinner with wine and grapes and oranges, all these goodies. It was 1943 during the war, and they brought him dead drunk at 5 o'clock in the morning. I don't remember that. My mother told me that when he came up, he just fell out of exhaustion and excitement that he saw this man.
So was he close to Stalin? Did he support Stalin?
No, close, you cannot say that, no. There were very few people who were really close to Stalin. No, he was one of these intellectuals that were believers that the Stalinist system is the best, and who was serving this system with wholeheartedly, I would say, till the moment that they, and all, of course, you shouldn't forget that the terror in this our country was such on such extent that out of terror people could have done a lot of things. That's one of the reasons I wanted to show this film to Americans, because you don't know what does it mean terror in your country. You're so lucky. Your system, of course, you have some fears, some anxieties, but never terror. State never terrorized your people, and you're happy. I envy you in that sense. My country had a lot of years of paranoia and, you know, and terror. I remember myself, you know, I'm not a very old man. I'm 54, but I remember till late 70s when I was talking on the phone, I was thinking always that someone is listening to me and that my phone is bugged and I have to think what I'm talking about. And I have to really care about, I have to watch my mouth. Although maybe no one listened, but this paranoia was engraved in our consciousness of Soviet people. So during this time of terror, a lot of intellectuals trying like blind themselves and just serve the system in order to survive. And also maybe some kind of, there was of course a faith. And later, of course, now my father is alive and he is lucky to see the disintegration of the society, of course, but also he feels that part of his life was thrown away serving false ideals.
So now he feels those ideals were false?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. He accepts it completely. He realizes that everything is false. And I remember last time I saw him this year and he told me, my God, I cannot imagine, I don't understand I cannot imagine that I was like this.
You've said that you were brainwashed when you were growing up as in the 40s and 50s, as all children were then growing up in the Soviet Union. What did your parents tell you about Stalin, and what were your attitudes toward him when you were young?
You see, my parents didn't have to tell me anything about Stalin. It's like in your country, you don't speak about God very much. It just exists there, and that's it. in that sense, it's like a religious family. They make some rituals. If you pray before the food, you don't have to pray to Stalin, but you know that Stalin is always there, somewhere in Kremlin, thinking about you. And that's how it started in the school. Stalin is our father, our best friend, and our caretaker. The portraits of Stalin were every day in newspaper. The portraits of Stalin were, you know, on the walls everywhere.
Even in your home?
In my home, no. I wouldn't say, no, in my home, no. My house was still my home was quite intellectual because my mother never was, I think, a Stalinist. And she was a Christian and she was a religious woman. And she had to hide her convictions, but in the house we didn't have this kind of officialdom. And
can I ask you to give us the English translation of your father's lyrics to the national anthem?
It's very. I don't remember them very well now, but it's basically "Long live the Union of Republics," something like this, and the Russia united all republics together, and there is. Lyrics, there are some lines talking about Stalin, and I think the reason why Stalin wanted to have a national anthem, because old national anthem was international, in the you know, this famous communist song, but this international didn't have Stalin's name, and he wanted to have a national anthem, of course, to have his name, and he didn't have to tell it to anyone who wrote the new national anthem. Every writer who wrote for competition mentioned Stalin in his text.
So how long was this?
Sorry?
I'm sorry. How long was the national anthem used?
This national anthem is still used, but the lyrics are different. I mean, the lyrics, they changed. They took Stalin's name out of it. But there were some lyrics about Stalin, like that Stalin raised our generations to be faithful to the country. Something like this. That was enough.
My guest is Soviet emigre film director Andrei Konchalovsky. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Soviet film director Andrei Konchalovsky, who has been making films in Hollywood since around 1979. His new film, The Inner Circle, is about Joseph Stalin's projectionist. Some of his other movies include Runaway Train and Shy People. Now, I know for a while your father was the head of the Writers' Union, which was the officially sanctioned writers' group in the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
One journalist once referred to him as a conservative watchdog of the Soviet literary scene. I wonder how his status affected you when you started making movies. Did it open up doors for you? Did it give you the opportunity to film subjects or to film in certain places that might have been off limits to other directors?
No. That's in that sense, it's just, I think, an opposite situation. You see, I have trouble. When I grew up and I started to study, I had a different, you know, it's a different generation. I was much more open to Western philosophy and Western ideology. We were already, you know, looking, we were children of de-Stalinization. And I had very strong confrontations with my father politically, because I was pro-Solzhenitsyn and I was pro-Pasternak, and I was at house I was a rebellion, and my father was afraid that I'm going to be, you know, arrested as a dissident, because I was liberal and I was against communism, basically, first thing. And second thing, you see, to be a son of a man of politics in totalitarian state doesn't help you. Because especially when you want to express completely opposite thoughts. My first film that I made was banned for 2 years. My second film was banned for 24 years. and it was banned anyway. But there is kind of paradox or irony in the sense that when directors like me did a film that was banned, everyone said, you know, of course he dared to make this film because his father is such and such. It's just an opposite thing, because I did it because of my convictions, not at all because I wanted. It was a conflict.
How did the censorship system operate while you were making films in the Soviet Union?
Censorship operated on the level of ideology, and never on the level of the market. That means that when you submit the film, I wrote 25 scripts as a film writer. Some of my films get banned also for several years as a script. So, but when you submit the script and the script is ideologically approved and the film is financed by the state, basically you can shoot whatever you want, because money is not a problem, wasn't a problem for the Soviet society. And the time and the labor, the cost of the film was not expensive. Therefore, you were allowed to make a film, and then no one watched what you're doing. Only when the film is finished, you present it to the film committee, and they suddenly see the film is not at all what was on the paper, and they can ban it. So about 40 films during that period were banned. But they were made, you know, they were made. So
what happened to your films that were banned? Did you get to keep a copy of them, or were they destroyed?
No, they were, they were banned and not destroyed. In Stalin time, some films were destroyed when they were banned. In the time of Brezhnev and Khrushchev, the banned films were kept on shelves, were shelved, and on one or two prints, and never shown. And when Perestroika came and Gorbachev and new generation of Soviet filmmakers came to power, there was a special commission that considered every film and released every film So my, for example, the film that has been banned in 1967 were released in 1989 in Russia with the kind of with a big success. It's, as I say, it's little, as they say, it's better late than never.
Well, let me ask you this. You moved, you left the Soviet Union to get more freedom in your life as well as in your movies. Yeah. But I'm wondering if you felt you found the filmmaking freedom that you wanted to in Hollywood, because Hollywood has its own set of restrictions. I mean, it's a completely different kind of restrictions than the Soviet Union, but still there are limits on what you could do. And
of course, yeah. Of course. Here is censorship of the market. Yes, it's different sort of restrictions. But you see, when I'm talking about freedom, I'm talking about freedom. It's not only freedom of creation, freedom to create your own life. What is important for the person, finally, to achieve the goal, it means to realize yourself according to how do you feel about yourself. I was lucky that I had a profession in my hands that I love and that I can be useful. But to realize your life, it means to at least to have opportunity. In Soviet system, no one could realize his own life unless you're really a devoted communist. And most of the people were lying about their convictions just in order to build a career.
Let me ask you a question about your new movie, The Inner Circle, about Stalinist projectionist, about mm-hmm. Stalin's projectionist. Are you glad that you got to make this movie before the end of the Soviet Union, that you had the chance to go back while there still was a Soviet Union and make one last film?
I was in Russia this year for post-production. We have to put, you know, we have to record the music. And I came in August, and it was perfect timing. I came into Moscow just on the eve of the coup. On the 17th of August, I came to Moscow. On the 18th of August, the tanks were on the streets. And I had to go to the studio, and I thought, my God, that's the end of the film. I will never be able to finish the film, and maybe they will keep me here. And I went to the studio, and it's unbelievable. 100 people, musicians, all came to the studio to make a recording because it was an American film, and because of their kind of a solidarity with the ideas that were in the film. And they came all 4 days of the coup. Every day they came, maybe too late, maybe sometimes they were late, but they came. It's like they were contribution. And meanwhile, behind the walls of the studio, the tanks are rumbling, and we had to stop recording sometimes because the studio was shaken. Unbelievable. And that was a very frightening experience.
Do you want to go back?
You see, I live between London and Los Angeles. I like to go to Moscow very often. I cannot go very often, but I'd like to go and see my family, my sister, my brother, see friends. I would like even to make a film sometimes, but not immediately because I have other plans. And I'm very happy that that communism is over. And in that sense, I can tell you, it will be very, very deep hangover. It's a deep hangover for Russia now to come back from that kind of a nightmare.
Andrei Konchalovsky, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much. I hope you like the film.
Andrei Konchalovsky's new film is The Inner Circle. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The flu came early this year. You may be wondering if it's too late to get a flu shot, or what good it would do if you got it. Coming up, some advice on the vaccine, what to do if you get the flu, and how to tell if you have it. We talk with Dr. Walter Gunn of the Centers for Disease Control. And rock critic Ken Tucker says he's changed his mind about James Taylor. He reviews Taylor's new album, New Moonshine, along with the Warren Zevon album, Mr. Bad Example. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Secretary of State James Baker spent today in the Kremlin discussing the safety of Soviet nuclear weapons and the political transformation of the Soviet Union. He held his most important meeting to date with Russian President Boris Yeltsin. From Moscow, NPR's Mike Schuster reports.
Baker said after his meeting with Yeltsin, also attended by the Soviet defense minister, that he had received quite a bit of specific detail involving questions of nuclear safety and control. Yeltsin announced that the Soviet republics where nuclear warheads are deployed intend to sign a joint defense treaty in which they will establish a united command and control system for their nuclear warheads. Yeltsin said that only Russia would eventually maintain its nuclear arsenal. He said that Ukraine, Belarus, and Kazakhstan intend to dismantle all of their nuclear weapons. The republics will ensure that no warheads will be diverted to third countries, Yeltsin added. Baker also met today with President Gorbachev and Foreign Minister Edward Shevardnadze, who admitted that foreign policy would soon be entirely in the hands of the former Soviet republics. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
Yeltsin also announced today that the new Commonwealth of Independent States will begin operating by the end of the month, with at least 10 of the 12 former Soviet republics taking part. And he said Russia will seek the Soviet Union's seat on the UN Security Council. The UN today reversed itself and voted to rescind its 1975 resolution that equated Zionism with racism. The vote was 111-25, with 13 abstentions, to revoke the resolution that condemned Zionism, the Jewish national movement that led to the creation of Israel. Meanwhile, the Middle East peace talks entered their second week at the State Department, with no reported movement among the parties. President Bush today observed the 200th anniversary of the signing of the Bill of Rights, praising its framers for establishing limits on the power of government. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
In a ceremony at Montpelier, the home of former President James Madison, Mr. Bush said the genius of the framers of the Bill of Rights was their attempt to limit their attention to truly important things, things over which a government can exercise some actual control.
Framers had the humble genius to recognize that man-made laws and government are not a panacea for human problems. They believe law and government, like good medicine, should seek first and foremost to do no harm.
Mr. Bush also used the occasion to promote his own ideas about the power of government. He equated the freedoms to assemble, worship, and to publish with the drive to restore voluntary school prayer and to encourage parental choice in education. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
Stocks closed higher on Wall Street today, with the Dow Jones Industrials gaining nearly 5 points to finish the day at 2919.05. Advances led declines by a margin of about 3-2 in active trading. This is National Public Radio News. A bombing that disrupted London rail service for 500,000 commuters this morning appears to be the seasonal work of the Irish Republican Army, according to officials. Authorities believe this morning's blast near Britain's busiest rail station is part of an IRA Christmastime campaign designed to cause the most disruption with the least resources. No one was injured in today's blast. The U.S. Conference of Mayors released its annual report today on the state of hunger and homelessness in 28 American cities. It confirms the problem is bad and getting worse. NPR's Phyllis Crockett reports.
Even though the number of emergency shelter beds rose overall in the cities surveyed, that could not keep pace with the need. The number of families seeking shelter rose by 17%. The number requesting emergency food jumped by 26%. Boston Mayor Ray Flynn, president of the U.S. Conference of Mayors, said the American people are as much to blame as the White House and the Congress.
How many times can we all turn a blind eye to the poverty and hunger and homelessness that is taking place in America's streets and sidewalks and doors and grates and parks and benches.
Flynn called on President Bush and the Congress to match every new dollar sent to help the people of the Soviet Union with new dollars to help hungry and homeless families here at home. I'm Phyllis Crockett in Washington.
A team of Khmer Rouge officials left Bangkok for Phnom Penh, the first to return to the Cambodian capital since its leaders were forced to flee to Thailand in November. A truck carrying 5 tons of nuclear fuel was hit by a car early today near Springfield, Massachusetts. Officials say although there was a fire, there was no leak of radioactive fuel. They say the car was traveling the wrong way on a major highway when it struck the truck. Officials say the driver of the car has been charged with drunken driving. This is National Public Radio News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I don't know what things are like at your home or where you work, but back in the Fresh Air office, Dorothy has been out sick for several days, Naomi has lost her voice, Amy was sick over Thanksgiving, Roberta and Danny got the flu vaccine. We wanted some advice about the flu and the vaccine, so we called Dr. Walter Gunn, an epidemiologist and flu specialist with the Centers for Disease Control. He's been tracking this year's flu viruses.
So far, we're seeing an early season. It started several weeks early. Back in October, we were picking up isolates of flu, laboratory-confirmed flu. We were seeing outbreaks in schools in November, and we've now had 2 nursing home outbreaks. The level of activity and the number of isolates is at least several weeks early. Typically, flu starts in December, peaks in February, and then goes away in about March. But in very bad years, it frequently starts early. But in other years where it started early, it might peak early and go away. It's kind of hard to tell. Nobody really knows whether we'll have an early peak and it'll go away or whether this is the beginning of a long season. Just not possible to tell.
You know, I've never had the flu vaccine, and I always thought that the flu vaccine was recommended primarily for people over 65 or for people who had respiratory problems or other problems that would leave them endangered if they had the flu. Now I'm reading in the newspaper that it's been recommended that, you know, virtually everybody get it. Can I ask you what you think about who should be getting the flu vaccine if, in fact, you can, if, in fact, your doctor has any?
Sure. The ACIP, the Immunization Practices Committee, recommends flu vaccine for anyone 6 months or older who doesn't want to get the flu, but it primarily stresses the importance of people who are in the high-risk group for complications to be immunized. And these are people who are 65 and older, even if they're in otherwise good health, people in nursing homes and chronic care facilities, people with chronic pulmonary and cardiovascular problems, including people with asthma, people with chronic metabolic diseases like diabetes or renal dysfunction, kidney problems, or immunosuppression, and also children and teenagers from 6 months to 18 years who happen to be on long-term aspirin therapy for other reasons because of the increased risk of Reye syndrome. But in addition to those people, the ACIP also recommends the vaccine for people who could potentially expose the high-risk people to influenza, such as doctors and nurses in hospitals and out-care patient settings, and also especially people who work in nursing homes or anyone who has a high-risk individual at home who they would expose, including children.
This would include people who work with people who have AIDS.
Yes, yes it does, because they would be at increased risk as well. That's one of the metabolic disorders I was mentioning.
So how effective is the flu vaccine?
It's very effective. It's 70 to 90% effective at preventing flu in a healthy young person. And it's about 50% effective at preventing flu in the elderly, but it's 85% effective at preventing hospitalization and death in the elderly. In other words, it'll protect half the elderly from getting the flu at all, and the bulk of the remainder would have their symptoms reduced by the vaccine.
Now, if I got a flu vaccine and I still got the flu, does that mean my symptoms would be reduced too?
Yes, yes, it should be. It takes about 2 weeks to build up full immunity. But if you get the flu in the meantime, your symptoms may be reduced.
Mm-hmm. If you have AIDS or if you test HIV positive, are you exposing yourself to risks if you take the flu vaccine?
No, fact, the vaccine is inactivated. You can't get the flu from the vaccine. And people who are immunocompromised, such as AIDS patients, should be immunized.
Well, I've been reading there isn't much vaccine left. What's the situation now?
Well, we've had reports of spot shortages, but that's typical in most years. We haven't had any general shortage that we're aware of. The manufacturers, and there are four of them, have manufactured 32 million doses this year. And, in fact, this week are releasing an additional 650,000 doses. So most of it is in the hands of private physicians. So if your health department perhaps has run out, then just check with the local physician. You should be able to find it.
You know, I sometimes have this attitude that I don't think is uncommon, that I don't really feel like putting toxins in my system, you know, through the vaccine. Is that a silly attitude to have?
Well, if a person happens to be in the high-risk group, then they are at great risk of complications for the flu. Therefore, the flu vaccine would definitely be a benefit to somebody who's in the high-risk group. Something on the order of 20,000 Americans die of influenza complications in an average flu year. And in even the lightest flu years, it's about 10,000 die. And in heavy years, like 1957 with the Asian flu, about 70,000 Americans died that year. So it's really a matter of providing protection for people who are in the high-risk groups in particular.
But if you're not in a high-risk group, you know, there's a concern that if you get the flu vaccine, maybe you'll get side effects. You know, maybe you'll not feel good for the next day or two.
And... Well, the vaccine is not recommended for people who have severe allergies to eggs because the vaccine is produced in eggs. And it's not recommended for people who currently have a fever. They should wait till the fever's over. But for other people getting the vaccine, very, very few people have any reaction at all. It's about 20 or 30% of the people who are vaccinated might have a very mildly sore arm for a day, maybe a degree of fever. But that's the typical reaction. But other than that, reactions are few and far between.
Did you get vaccinated?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm not in the high-risk group yet, but I get vaccinated.
My guest is Dr. Walter Gunn of the Centers for Disease Control. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the flu with Dr. Walter Gunn, who is an epidemiologist and flu specialist at the Centers for Disease Control. When you have the flu, at what point is it worth seeing a doctor? And I ask that knowing that there's no medicine that's going to kill a virus.
Well, okay, two things. One is it's always a good idea to call your doctor when you get the flu anyway. There may be something about your particular health status that would cause him to want to take some special precautions. So I advise you, always call your doctor and let him know. Number two, there is a drug that's effective at combating the flu. It's called amantadine, and this is a prescription drug which can reduce the symptoms of influenza. It's used particularly in nursing home outbreaks. It both prevents the flu and it reduces the symptoms once you have it.
For all the strains or just for one strain?
For the A strain in particular.
And there's a lot of that going around this year?
Right now, 99% of what we're seeing out there is A.
Any side effects?
There are side effects. They have to be carefully monitored for dizziness and mm-hmm. Nausea. But that's why it's a prescription drug. You have to monitor that.
When is an antibiotic appropriate when you have the flu? Antibiotics kill bacteria, they don't kill viruses.
That's
but doctors right. often prescribe antibiotics when you're home with the flu.
Yeah, they do. If they're particularly concerned about the development of a secondary bacterial infection, then they sometimes administer antibiotics. When you have influenza, you develop a fever early on, and the fever usually goes down within a few days. But if it is going down and then suddenly rises again, that's a good indication that you might be developing a secondary infection, and you should, in particular, then call your doctor, let your doctor know that you spiked a second temperature.
When you say secondary infection, you mean maybe like a bacterial respiratory infection?
That's right. Yeah, right. Pneumonia.
But what is it about a virus that is so difficult to attack as compared to a bacterial infection?
Well, viruses actually get into cells and have some protection by being inside the cells. So they're more difficult to deal with that way.
Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people are so pressured at work that even though they feel like they're coming down with the flu or that they have the flu, they're going to drag themselves into work. Is that a really foolish thing to do?
Well, it does expose other people. A person who has the flu is infectious and can infect other people, usually from about one day before they have any symptoms until about anywhere from 3 to 5 days into the illness.
Are there any special precautions for treating children who have the flu?
Yes, parents should be reminded not to give aspirin or any product containing aspirin to children or teenagers for symptoms of the flu or chickenpox because of the increased risk of Reye syndrome, which is often fatal.
What's the difference between the flu and a cold? And if you're not going to a doctor who's going to take a culture, can you really be sure what you have?
You cannot be sure of what you have unless you have it cultured, that the symptoms are frequently quite similar. And it takes a laboratory test to actually tell whether it's flu or not. And we have nursing home outbreaks that we respond to. And we send epidemiologists out and get throat swabs and culture. And then after a few days, we're able to tell what's actually going on there.
Does it matter if you have a low fever and you don't feel good and you've got all the kind of respiratory symptoms that might be a cold or might be a flu, does it matter if you know what you have?
If you were in a high-risk group if you thought there's a chance that you're coming down with influenza, it does matter because they could administer amantadine, which would reduce your symptoms and possibly save your life.
Does flu always come with a fever?
Yes. Sudden onset of fever, chills, myalgia, muscle aches pains, and dry cough and a red sore throat, characteristic of flu.
You mentioned a dry cough. Why is it a dry cough that comes with the flu?
Cough, because bacterial infections frequently result in mucus being produced, which would be sort of a wet cough. But flu typically has a dry cough.
So if your flu suddenly turns into a really productive cough, is that a sign you might have a secondary infection?
Quite possible.
Mm-hmm. Why is it that the flu strain changes every year?
The influenza virus mutates regularly. There are shifts and there's drift. The drift are fairly minor changes in the genetic structure, but occasionally there are shifts where it's a major change. And in those years, we see more mortality because the population hasn't had experience with that particular virus.
Even there's no immunity.
That's right. Wouldn't have any natural immunity to it.
Why are the flus called like the Asian flu or the Beijing flu? Is this where the flu strain originated?
It's where the flu strain is first isolated. And they're not all Asian. We've had A Mississippi and A Texas and A New Jersey and A Russia and A England. So they're isolated all around the world, but they frequently are from Asia, and no one knows really why.
Well, I wish you good health, and I thank you very much for talking with us.
You too. Bye now.
Dr. Walter Gunn is an epidemiologist and flu specialist at the Centers for Disease Control. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Well, Robert, the prosecution wrapped up its case in the Noriega trial. Are you going to bring us up to date?
We will. We'll hear the news of the trial from Melissa Mancini, who's been covering it in Miami for us. And we'll also be talking about how the prosecution did and what it didn't do with our very own editor and biographer of Manuel Noriega, John Dingus. Also today, news of Secretary of State Baker's visit to the Soviet Union and his talks there with Russian President Boris Yeltsin and Soviet Foreign Minister Eduard Shevardnadze. A report on transitional housing, a program that's being used for the homeless in Fairfax County, Virginia, and Songs of the Holocaust.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. James Taylor and Warren Zevon are singer-songwriters with very different sensibilities who both came to prominence in the 70s and both have new albums. Our rock critic Ken Tucker likes both records. Zevon's has so far failed to dent the pop charts. Taylor's is a top 40 hit, and he's currently embarked on a sold-out tour.
I like to think about the time I met you, living with you.
Rock critics of a certain generation are falling all over themselves to be nice to James Taylor's latest record, New Moonshine. That's because it's a pretty darn good record, and also because many of the writers who used to dump on Taylor as being a wimpy folky in the 70s are admitting that the wistfulness of Taylor's songs at their best has turned out to be the emotional soundtrack of many baby boomers' lives. Speaking as a veteran Taylor dumper, I myself wondered whether I liked this album for its music, or because my hairline is starting to resemble Sweet Baby James's these days. In any case, the best song by far on New Moonshine is Copperline, a beautifully crafted song that's a collaboration between Taylor and the novelist Reynolds Price, or as a Columbia Records press release calls him, noted Southern author Ralph Price.
One summer night on the Copperline, slip away past supper time, with smoke and moonshine, down on Copperline. One time I saw my daddy dancing, watched him moving like a man in a trance. He brought it back from the war in France, down on the Copperline. French water and tomato wine, creosote and turpentine, sample mass and new moonshine, down on Copperline. Down on Copperline.
James Taylor has moved beyond his early autobiographical lyrics to write moody narrative pieces about the death of idealism and death itself. Shed a Little Light is a bravely sentimental piece about Martin Luther King and the faded hopes of the civil rights movement, while The Frozen Man is an oddly moving character sketch about a drowned 19th century sailor sealed up in an iceberg for a century.
Last thing I remember is the freezing cold, water reaching up just to swallow me whole. Ice in the rigging and howling wind, shock to my body as we tumbled in. Merciful God. Then my brothers and the others are lost at sea. I alone am returned to tell thee, getting in ice for a century, to walk the world again.
On the considerable strength of this album, it's probably safe to say that James Taylor has aged into a responsible artist and human being. But those of us who prefer our singer-songwriters less mannerly have a reliable source of inspiration in Warren Zevon, whose admirable new album is called Mr. Bad Example.
I started as an older boy, working at the church, learning all my holy moves, doing some research, which led me to a cash box labeled Children's Fund.
I'd leave the change and tuck the bills inside my cummerbund. I've got a part-time job at my father's carpet store, laying tackless stripping and housewives by the score. I loaded up their furniture and took it to Spokane and auctioned off every last Naugahyde divan.
As he has since his debut 15 years ago, Warren Zevon takes the conventions of the 70s singer-songwriter and blows them up, exploding verses with his booming voice, pushing his lyrics' supposedly autobiographical details into a rude surrealism. Although their songs and sensibilities couldn't be more different, Taylor and Zevon have frequently drawn upon the same pool of Los Angeles musicians, including the guitarist Waddy Wachtel, who produced Zevon's new album and who's mentioned in passing in a song called Things to Do in Denver When You're Dead.
I was working on a steak the other day, and I saw Waddy in the Rattlesnake Cafe, dressed in black, tossing back a shot of rye, finding things to do in Denver when you die. Priest, maybe you should find a place to stay.
Where James Taylor employs laid-back LA session players to complete his impeccable music, Zevon has always used their precision as an ironic counterpoint to rampaging rants like Werewolves of London, Lawyers, Guns, and Money, and the title song of the new album. Mr. Bad Example isn't as compelling as Zevon's early records because there isn't as much at stake. He sings as if he's resigned to the idea that he'll never be a star. But in such hopelessness lies a sense of freedom, and Warren Zevon makes being an aging reprobate sound like an admirable calling.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Thad Kirk, and Audrey Voblaitis. Roberta Shurak directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Susan Misalas risked her life photographing the Sandinista Revolution. She recently returned to Nicaragua to make a film tracking down the people she photographed to find out what their lives are like now. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Misalas about her more than 10 years taking pictures in Central America. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us.